Our show's name pays tribute to the Boer Trekkers of South Africa, who in 1838 soundly defeated 30,000 Zulus on the bank of the Nkomo River, thereafter called Blood River, from the water turning red with the blood of the slain. Miraculously, no Boer Trekker died and only three were wounded. Now, your friend, Eddie Miller, will be your ambassador for tonight's show.
Dear Blood River Radio, thank God the infantry, the A-teams here. We've had great people on. We've really missed the Bitter Ender. He's back. He's been fighting behind enemy lines. I hope they don't get him. I hope he doesn't get caught wearing the Yankee uniform, because if you're caught wearing the Yankee uniform, they can hang you as a spy. But as long as he was in his Confederate uniform, well, they'd probably hang him anyway, the way these low-down Yankees are. But anyway, he's back. And he's back. He still has part of a sword left, but at least he's got part of it. That's better than he's been doing. Been destroying the whole damn thing. Maybe we can get this thing. Maybe he can just use it as a dagger, because we're running out of money to buy swords. But how you doing, Bitter Ender?
Doing very well. Doing very well. Sorry I had to miss the program last week. I was visiting my brother and my cousin out in Texas. And, of course, that was not behind enemy lines. Hood's Texas Brigade and Terry's Texas Rangers that fought with Forrest. So they are very pro-Southern out there. And they still have the Patrick Claiborne statue in, they call it Claiborne, Texas. But they still have the statue there and the statue of General Hiram Granberry in Granberry, Texas, when General Granberry was one of the Confederate officers that was killed. Well, so was Patrick Claiborne, but General Granberry was one of the officers that was killed at the Battle of Franklin. In fact, Claiborne and Granberry both were killed there, two of the five Confederate officers that were killed there. So they're standing up for their Southern history. They hadn't buffaloed them into knuckling under. So real proud of the Texans out there. In fact, that was Granberry's last words when they were making that assault against the Federal lines, earthworks at Franklin. He said, "Forward, men, forward. Never let it be said that Texans lag in a fight." And he was shot and killed about 30 seconds after that.
Wow.
So anyway, it was a good trip and really enjoyed it, and glad to be back in Tennessee and getting ready to crank up another episode on Blood River Radio. So
we can't wait. You've been sorely missed, Gene. You certainly have. We really miss you. Great to have you back.
Thank you, brother. Appreciate that. I thought we'd do something a little bit different today. I have done this program before for some SCV camps, and I have three great big illustration boards. So our listeners are going to have to, since I don't think they can see the maps that we're going to show on radio, so our listeners are going to have to use their imagination a little bit. But we're going to compare what happened in three very famous battles. Waterloo in Brussels, Belgium, Gettysburg in our War for Southern Independence in 1863, and then compare that with what happened at a battle in 1864 down at Bryce's Crossroads in northern Mississippi under Nathan Bedford Forrest. So, that being said, we will pick up in chronological order. We will start off with Waterloo first, since that was in 1815. And just a background behind that, Napoleon had been sent to Elba, an island out in the Mediterranean, after the collapse of the French army after the Russian invasion. But on March 1st of 1815, he returned from Elba. Landed at Cannes. I don't know if the film festival was going on then at Cannes. Probably not. But anyway, he marched to Paris and began organizing an army. Between March and June, he prepared for war because he knew all the Allies were going to come after him. And he had the army that he could put in the field, about 188,000, and then another 100,000 in forts and depots all over France. And then he had about 300,000 additional recruits, draftees, whatever you want to call them, that were being trained around Paris. And his Army of the North numbered about 124,000, and they were concentrated around Paris. So the Allies weren't idly sitting around and watching all this happen. About the same time, June 1st, the Allies were concentrating their army on the French and Belgian border. In Belgium, it was Wellington, and a English-Dutch army, about 95,000, and then Blücher's Prussian army, about 124,000, and not including another corps in Luxembourg, about 26,000. There was a German army, about 210,000, along the Rhine River from Mons to Basel. And then in northern Italy, the Austrian army, 75,000. And then there's a Russian army moving west, about 167,000, coming through Prussia. So with all this bearing down on him, Napoleon did what he always did. That was striking first before all these armies could unite. And he figured they were probably going to all get together about mid-July. And he decided to take the offensive and knock off one at a time. So his first shot was at the ones that were closest to him. That was the English army, English and Dutch army under Wellington in Belgium and under Blücher. So he decided that he would leave Paris, march north, and on June the 11th, he left Paris secretly and concentrated near Charleroi on June 14th. And what he did, he placed his army right in between the armies of Wellington and Blücher. Now, to get to either one of those, the Prussians or the English, to reinforce each other, they were going to have to go through Napoleon's army. So he was in a key position there. And he knew that before they could concentrate 15 miles to the west, the key point was a little crossroads town of Quatre Bras, sitting right between the two Allied armies. On June 16th, he fought two battles at one time, the Battle of Ligny and Quatre Bras. And Napoleon ordered one of his chief officers, Marshal Ney, to seize Quatre Bras with the left wing of the French army. And then with the center and the right wing of the army, about 77,000 men, Napoleon fell on Blücher's 83,000 at Ligny. And by afternoon of the 16th, he had knocked the Prussians back and ordered Ney, who he thought had already seized the road junction, to strike Blücher from the right flank and completely destroy the Prussian army. But at Quatre Bras, B-R-A-S, Ney was dilly-dallying, procrastinating, and had permitted his 25,000 men to be held off by a small British brigade until the evening of the 16th. And then that gave Wellington time to gather about 36,000 men. So if you imagine this on a map, you're looking kind of a squashed out V with the Prussians over to the east or to the right, and Wellington and the British army over to the left, and Napoleon south of them and kind of in the middle. And he wanted to get these two armies defeated before they could come together. That was the whole point, was to defeat one and then the other before they could come together. The British counterattacked against Ney. Meanwhile, Marshal Jean-Baptiste Durand had a corps in the French army, about 20,000 men, moving from in the reserve toward Marshal Ney. And through a confusion of orders, and probably Ney's fault, this large French force of 20,000 men spent the day marching to and fro, back and forth between the two French armies. He started to Ney, and Ney told him, no, he needs to go to the east and help Napoleon. He went to the east, and then he had orders to turn around and go back west. Spent the whole day of the 16th marching back and forth, and never aided either army, either Napoleon or Ney. And so they never did destroy the Prussians like they had planned to. On June the 17th and 18th, there was a delayed French pursuit of the defeated English army under Wellington. In that morning, Napoleon sent Admiral Commander Grouchy with the right wing of his army, about 33,000, to go after the Prussian army and make sure that if he couldn't defeat him, put your men between the Prussians and the English so they can't come together. By this time, Wellington had fallen back towards Brussels and was taking up a defensive position on the ridge at south of a little town called Waterloo. Ney had failed to pursue, and it was not until mid-afternoon that Napoleon succeeded in getting his forces in movement after the British. And what happened was a torrential rainstorm hampered the French advance. These were dirt roads, of course, and they were just mired down in the mud. The attack was supposed to go that afternoon of the 17th, but with all the rain, they couldn't move. So Napoleon postponed the battle until June the 18th, and we will come back after the break and tell you what happened then.
Thank you so much, Gene. Be right back, folks.
Get ready to be part of something incredible. We're breaking barriers and delivering the powerful stories that mainstream media won't touch. Your support is what fuels our mission to revolutionize journalism and bring you the truth. Join our passionate community of changemakers by donating at libertynewsradio.com today. Together, we're creating the future of news.
During our war for Southern independence, the brilliant Confederate general Robert E. Lee foretold the decline of this country when he prophesied, "If those people," referring to the dictatorial federal government, "if those people win this war, the United States will become a bully abroad and a tyrant at home." As Lee predicted, it has come to pass. The principles laid out in our founding documents, our Declaration of Independence, and the individual rights protected in our Constitution have been vilified and discarded. But not everyone has surrendered. Blood River Radio brings you highly respected, intelligent guests not afraid to speak the truth when the truth in America today is censored and attacked. Your contributions keep us on the air in order to fight against the bullies abroad and the tyrants at home. Send your war contributions to Blood River Radio, P.O. Box 34636, Bartlett, Tennessee 38184. That address is on our website, www.bloodriverradio.com. Don't let the bullies and the tyrants win.
Do you know what is great about America? Ask an immigrant. Ask an Immigrant is a new podcast dedicated to helping Americans, especially our youth, value, appreciate, and be grateful for the freedoms we have here in America. Join host Lydia Wallace Nuttall as she interviews immigrants from around the world to discover their inspiring personal stories about why they came to America. To learn more about why America is the most prosperous, greatest country in the world, download the Loving Liberty app or go to lovingliberty.net.
In the morning. Smells like victory.
Blood Group Radio family, thank you so much for hanging on. And I'd just like to say, I give a shout out one more time to dear Pam, Sister Pam, and Brother Dennis. They're listening. They're listening all the way over in Paris, France. Gene, we have, Dennis. Yeah, Dennis and Pam, you know them. We saw them, we've seen them several times at the TPC organizations, but, they're over in Paris, and they're listening live before they get ready to board a boat to go on their cruise up to, Norway, all the way up to the Arctic Circle. But anyway, back to you.
Oh, golly.
Yeah.
That's going to be a great trip.
I know they'll love you. As a matter of fact, you and me, we saw them, and they gave us some molasses the last time we were up in Greenville,
yes.
South Carolina.
That was excellent. That was really good, and I thank them very much. We'll pass that thanks on to them.
Well, I know they're listening.
Very gracious folks there.
Yes,
we appreciate
that.
They
support the show. They love us to death. We love them back. But anyway, go ahead back, Bitterender, and continue on your excellent commentary.
Well, we were talking about how Napoleon and the French army were trying to knock off all of these allies that were coming after them, from the English, the Prussians, Germans along the Rhine, the Austrians, and hit them one at a time before they could unite and just totally crush the French army. And he'd done a pretty good job on the 16th of defeating both the Prussian army under Blücher and stymieing and stopping the English army under Wellington. But now he was worried that they were going to come together. They had an officer that was marching enough reinforcements back and forth between the two battles that were going on the 16th of June, if he had sided with either where Napoleon was or Marshal Ney was to the west, they could have either destroyed the Prussians or destroyed the English army. And this officer, because of contradicting our orders, was just marching back and forth between these two battles and never helped out in either one. So Napoleon wanted to continue the battle on the 17th of June, but a terrific rainstorm had come in and just bogged down everything on the countryside and couldn't move. So now we go to the 18th of June, which was the date for the Battle of Waterloo, and Napoleon even delayed his attack against the English until about noon to let the roads dry out where he could actually move his artillery. Another thing that helped, that gave the Prussians under Blücher to the east of them time to get reorganized and pull back together. And the army, or part of his army, the corps that he had sent to take care of Blücher under Grouchy failed him. And this is so typical of battles. So you have orders, you have a plan, and then you have people that can't or won't carry it out. And that affects the outcome of the battle, which we will see here. It affected the outcome of a whole country. And when we get to Gettysburg, the next battle we're going to talk about, it affected the outcome of our war for independence, failure of subordinate commanders. So this was another failure of a subordinate commander. Marshal Grouchy, with about a third of the French army, was supposed to pursue the Prussians, defeat them if he could, but the main thing was swing over to the west and make sure that the Prussians didn't go west and unite with Wellington and the British. He failed to do that. He just kind of walked along like he was out on a picnic stroll or something, haphazard pursuit of the Prussian army, and didn't really make a hard effort to engage them or attack the rear of their column and get them engaged in a battle to keep them from going west and uniting with Wellington. Now, during the battle at Waterloo, Napoleon, as we said, was late getting the attacks going, and the British were really taking a beating. Their line had fallen back and fallen back. It didn't break, though. It held on. It tried some mistakes. Ney sent the cavalry across this valley to attack the British lines and without any infantry support. And they broke through and pierced the British lines, but they had no support to follow up. And then the Prussian elements began to come into the field from the east, and Napoleon put his Imperial Guards in there, his crack troops, to try to finish off the British. But by that time, enough Prussians had arrived to overcome the Imperial Guard, and without cavalry, they struck at the British center. But now the Prussians were on the field, and they attacked them from the flank. And Blücher's full strength, about 61,000, was now engaged, overlapping the French right flank. And as the guard fell back, Wellington then counterattacked. The French army collapsed into just a mob of refugees, basically. This is really a horrific battle in history. Losses were really great on both sides. Wellington lost about 15,000 men, Blücher about 7,000, and the French lost over 30,000. About 7,000 of those were prisoners that were taken there on the field. So by June 21st, Napoleon abdicated and surrendered to the British. He was put on a British warship on July 15th, and he was exiled on the island of St. Helena. Off the South American coast, where he would die only about 6 years later in May of 1821. So anyway, that is an example of what happens when subordinate officers can't follow the directions that they were giving. And another thing that we're going to talk about on our third battle we're going to talk about today is how a commander will have to follow up. You give orders. This is the military. You're supposed to follow orders. The orders you give, though, don't necessarily mean that they're being followed, and you always have to follow up on it. The second battle we're going to talk about is over here on this side of the ocean, the Battle of Gettysburg that was fought in Gettysburg, Pennsylvania on July 1st, 2nd, and 3rd of 1863. So we back up to June the 3rd, and Robert E. Lee, the commanding army of the Army of Northern Virginia, has planned to invade the North. Now, the Confederates weren't stupid. They understood that they could win these victories against the Northern armies, against McClellan in the 7 days, Pope at Second Manassas, Chancellorsville, Fredericksburg. They were all victories, but they couldn't destroy the Federal Army of the Potomac. And the Confederates knew that, yes, they could win, but they couldn't replace the losses they were taking, either in individual enlisted men or in a lot of the officers that were they were losing. Of course, they lost Thomas Stonewall Jackson at Chancellorsville, and a lot of the division commanders had been killed in these earlier battles. So what happens when you lose your top officers? Then you're bringing officers up from smaller commands that have never commanded a division or never commanded an entire Army Corps. And all of a sudden, they're thrust into a position of command where they really don't have the experience to take over that command. So that was happening. But Lee decided that if they could invade the North, win a battle on Northern soil, and then destroy the army, the Union Army of the Potomac, and turn on Washington, D.C., they could get some kind of armistice or peace agreement that the North would be war-weary and Lincoln may be thrown out of office, and possibly we could get our gain our independence. Wasn't going to happen. That was a policy that Richmond government under Davis kept thinking, one big victory, and that will do it. But the Confederates had victories, but they couldn't destroy the Army of the Potomac because they were usually fighting two against one odds. The Union Army was usually about twice the size of the Confederate Army in most of these battles in the East, and not only in the East, but out here in the Western Theater as well. So, yes, the Confederates could win, but they didn't have enough men left at the end of a two-day battle or a horrible one-day battle to finish off the Army of the Potomac. So they're going to try it one more time. The Army of Northern Virginia then slips across the passes in the Blue Ridge Mountains in Virginia. Jeb Stuart's cavalry is guarding these passes, so the Federal Army under Joe Hooker has no idea that the Confederate Army of Northern Virginia has disappeared and gone over the mountains and into the Shenandoah Valley. On June 13th and 14th, Richard Ewell's corps, the Second Corps, which is formerly Stonewall Jackson's corps, sweeps down on Winchester, Virginia, and captures Winchester and most of the Federal soldiers there. On the 23rd, 24th of June, Lee crosses the Potomac. His army is about 76,000 strong and pushes northward into Pennsylvania through Chambersburg and near Carlisle in York, Pennsylvania, by the 28th. Finally, General Hooker, the Federal Army commander, thinks that Lee's army is sitting out in front of him when they've gone, been gone for a week, and it's civilians along the Potomac River that send the word that, hey, there's a large Confederate army crossing the Potomac and heading into Maryland. And he decides, well, I think we better do something about that. So he turns around and heads north, trying to catch up to Lee's army. Lee's army is on the west side or left side of the mountain range, and Hooker is on the east or the right-hand side of this mountain range. And neither one of them know very much about where either one of them are. The problem with Lee's army, a lot of his cavalry under Jeb Stuart was still down in Virginia guarding these passes. And once they saw that the Federal Army had left and they weren't going to be coming through these mountain passes, Turner's Gap and Thoroughfare Gap, all the gaps in the Blue Ridge Mountains there, he had a choice to make. And Lee kind of left him discretionary orders. And we will talk about what happened with those orders when we come back from the break.
Can't wait to hear it, Gene. Be right back, folks.
Hi.
How would you like to help this program reach more people and earn silver at the same time? Call or text 801-669-2211 for complete details.
News this hour from townhall.com. I'm Jason Walker. U.S. unemployment rate up slightly.
The Labor Department reports an increase of 0.1% from 4.1 to 4.2%, where it's remained for the past 13 months. The department estimates the number of unemployed in the U.S. at some 7.2 million people. Earlier this week, Fed Chair Jerome Powell assessed the U.S. job market as stable.
The unemployment rate remains low, and the labor market is at or near maximum employment.
The report says the economy added 73,000 jobs, but also revised downward the previous 2 months of payroll statistics by 258,000, negating those previously reported gains. George Williams, Washington.
Warren Buffett's company reporting less than half as much profit in the second quarter as it took a $3.76 billion write-down on the value of its stake in Kraft Heinz, as the food producer considers largely undoing the merger that Berkshire Hathaway helped bankroll. Berkshire says it earned $12.37 billion in the quarter because it recorded a smaller gain on its investments compared to last year when it unloaded a chunk of its Apple stake. Also at townhall.com, smoke from Canadian wildfires has hovered over several Midwestern states today, bringing mornings of unhealthy air. Air quality alerts in effect in Iowa, Minnesota, Michigan, Wisconsin, and parts of Nebraska, Illinois, and Indiana. Corporation Public Broadcasting will begin taking steps toward its own closure after being defunded by the Senate. Demise of CPB, a direct result of the president's targeting it. Mr. Trump, who has called the CPB a monstrosity, has long said public broadcasting should not receive taxpayer money. More on these stories at townhall.com.
This special alert is for all Americans who own a vehicle. If you have a warranty that's about to expire or no warranty coverage at all, this message is for you. It's time to stop worrying about future car repairs today. Your vehicle is essential, but unexpected breakdowns can derail your plans and your wallet. It's time to future-proof your ride with CarShield. CarShield offers a low-cost, month-to-month vehicle protection plan that saves drivers thousands from out-of-pocket expenses on future auto repairs. Imagine if your engine quits or your transmission fails. You could pay a fraction of the repair cost. This protection plan is at an all-time low, and to give you even more peace of mind, drivers who activate today also receive free roadside assistance, free towing, and car rental options at no additional cost. Don't wait for a breakdown to drain your savings. Future-proof your car with CarShield today and drive with confidence. Call CarShield for your free quick quote. Call 800-894-9190. That's 800-894-9190. What do you have to lose? Call 800-894-9190. That's 800-894-9190. Again, 800-894-9190.
This is Michael Hill, Chief of the League of the South. I listen to Blood River Radio, and you should too. In fact, you should be telling your friends, your family, and your associates to listen to Eddie Miller and the good folks at Blood River Radio. They stand resolutely for the preservation of white civilization, what we once called Christendom, and they stand against the ongoing campaign of white genocide. In these trying and uncertain times, it's more important than ever to speak and act in defense of our God, our people, and our civilization. Blood River Radio speaks the truth and speaks it boldly. I've been on this show many times as a guest, and I'm very proud of my association with you. May our just cause prevail. Hail victory.
In the medical field, IT security is crucial. Our highly skilled consultants are HIPAA certified and have 20 plus years of experience servicing medical clinics, billing, and supply companies. We offer comprehensive endpoint protection, guarding your computers and servers against all stages of threats. And with our 24/7 monitoring services, you'll never worry about extensive downtime again. Ready to level up your IT support? Call 801-706-6980 today and discover how great IT services can be with Managed IT Services.
Step into the boots of the American West with Range Magazine, where grit meets grace. This is a front row seat to the stories, struggles, and triumphs of ranchers, farmers, and stewards of the land. From jaw-dropping photography to no-nonsense reporting, Range brings you the untold tales of life on the range. Whether you're a city dweller with a cowboy's heart or living life where the pavement ends, Range speaks to the soul of the West. Subscribe today at rangemagazine.com.
Hello, Blood River Radio family. I wish y'all could hear what goes on during the break sometimes. Maybe you can hear some of it because we have time. But anyway, without further ado, without holding up the professor anymore, we're going to go right back to the professor, a.k.a. the Bitter Ender. He wears many hats. Besides, he does more than just tear up swords on Yankees. He's a resident professor of history. So go ahead, Bitter Ender.
Okay, we're talking about the Lee's Army of Northern Virginia crossed the Potomac into Maryland, headed for Pennsylvania. And this was something that Stonewall Jackson had said a year before he was killed at Chancellorsville. He said, we can't keep fighting these defensive battles in Virginia. We've got to take the war to the north and get into Pennsylvania and destroy these coal mines and bring things like that and bring the war to the population of the north. They don't care. It's all being fought in Virginia. And they just keep sending troops and supplies down there and destroying the countryside and the towns in Virginia. They don't care. In Pennsylvania, New Jersey, New York, Maine, Massachusetts, they're not fighting any battles up there. They could care less how long the war goes on, unless they had a son or a father, husband, or somebody in the war. They weren't really affected by it, except they were making a lot of money off of it. But so Jackson's idea was to take the war into Pennsylvania, destroy those coal mines in eastern Pennsylvania and bring the war to these people and try to get some kind of armistice or settlement. So that's the whole reason the Army of Northern Virginia was going on an offensive campaign. So we said that the Army had left. They'd been screened by the Blue Ridge Mountains. They were crossing the Potomac, and Jeb Stuart's cavalry was holding the passes in the Blue Ridge Mountains. Now Hooker finally finds out that there's a huge Confederate army crossing the Potomac, and he heads north. So now Stuart, if he's going to catch up to Lee's army, he's got to turn around, actually go south, and then over the mountains and come up the Shenandoah Valley, and he's trailing Lee's army. So he decides, rather than doing that and being two or three days behind Lee's army, he's simply going to swing around Hooker's army, go to the east, swing around him, and catch up with Lee somewhere up in Pennsylvania. Now, this is what Stuart had done against McClellan back in the early part of the war, when McClellan was on the almost at the gates of Richmond, and Stuart rode all the way around his army and started on the northern side and swung all the way around to the southern side of the Federal Army and came back into Richmond from the south to find out information that McClellan's right flank was just sticking out in the air. And, of course, that's where Lee launched the attacks for the 7 days battle. So he thought he was going to be doing the same thing again. The difference was McClellan's army was sitting still, and McClellan was somebody that didn't want to move unless Lincoln threatened to remove him from command. And so Stuart, back in May and June of 62, he was riding around a stationary army. This time, in June of 63, he's trying to ride around an army that's also on the move. So when he swung to the east and got between Hooker and Washington, every time he tried to turn back to the left or turn back to the west, he ran into part of Hooker's Federal Army. Well, he couldn't chop his way through them. So he would have to swing back, go north a little bit more, try to swing back to the west, hit the Federal Army again, turn back to the east, go north, and try to get back again. So this was the problem. So he was separated from Lee's army with the entire Federal Army between him. We go down to June 30th. A Confederate brigade is going into Gettysburg, and they run into Federal cavalry at Gettysburg. And now Lee is getting word from some spies that he had out covering the countryside that the Federal Army is coming after him. And the Federal Army is a lot closer to Lee's army than he thought. And he's better get his army pulled together, because parts of his army were all the way up almost to Harrisburg, capital of Pennsylvania, on the south side of the Susquehanna River. Carlisle, York, they're spread all over Pennsylvania. So he's looking at a map, and there's a town called Gettysburg where it seems like all the roads come in from north, south, east, and west. They decide this is the rally point. They're going to unite there and figure out where the Federal Army is coming from. So they're coming to Gettysburg. On July 1st, the battle opens. A.P. Hill's corps is coming up from the west, coming up the Chambersburg Pike, and Richard Ewell's corps is coming down from the north. He was up at Carlisle and York. A.P. Hill runs into the Union Army 1st Corps just west of Gettysburg, and the battle starts in the morning of July 1st. And then the 1st Corps is reinforced by Oliver Howard's 11th Corps of the Union Army. So now Hill and his two divisions are outnumbered by 2 corps. When it looks like the Confederates are going to be in trouble, Richard Ewell's corps with his divisions are coming down on Gettysburg from the north, and now they catch the Union Army in a vise. The Confederates are coming head on from the west, and Ewell is coming down on their right flank from the north, and the Federal Army on July 1st is routed off the field. They go running through the town of Gettysburg, across fields. Some of the soldiers are hiding in basements of houses. Anything they can do to get away from the Confederates, and they run up this hill right outside the town of Gettysburg called Cemetery Hill, where the main cemetery is, and start taking defensive positions there. Once again, failure of subordinate commanders. Ewell is ordered to attack that hill, if at all practicable, by Lee, and Ewell loses his nerve and doesn't attack and finish off the Federal Army on the late afternoon of July 1st. And that was always compared to Ewell was commanding the 2nd Corps in the Army of Northern Virginia, which was Stonewall Jackson's old corps. And a lot of people have said, well, Jackson wouldn't stop. Once he had the enemy on the run, he could smell blood. And he was going to stay on them like a bulldog until that Federal Army was destroyed. But Ewell held up, gave the Federal Army a chance to dig in that night and take a strong position up on Cemetery Hill overlooking the town of Gettysburg. So that night, of course, they're planning their strategy. Scouts have gone out, scouted the Federal lines. They said there are 2 hills down at the south there that are unoccupied. If we can get down there and put our artillery up there, we can blast the Federals off of this Cemetery Hill, and then there's a ridge that runs down south called Cemetery Ridge. We can put our artillery up there, and they'll be in an untenable position. So Lee orders his 1st Corps commander, James Longstreet, to move his 2 divisions that are there on the field, McLaws and Hood. George Pickett's division still coming up. They were guarding the wagon train at the very end of the column, so they wouldn't get there till night of July 2nd. But he's got 2 divisions there, McLaws and Hood, to send them and take those hills. And he's ordered to go down there at 8 o'clock in the morning on July 2nd. Now, Longstreet's pouting. When they left Virginia, they decided they were going to Pennsylvania, take a good defensive position, and make the Federal Army come after them and slaughter them in a defensive position, just like they had done against the Federal Army at Fredericksburg. And now, all of a sudden, everything had shifted. They're fighting an offensive battle. And it's like football coach says, oh, we're going to practice on the run. That's all we're doing. We're not going to throw the ball. Well, you get into the game, and you got an 8-man front, and you're not running against 8 in the gap. So you better be able to throw the ball. Well, no. We practiced on running the ball. We're not going to throw it. So that's basically what Longstreet was doing. He thought he was head coach or commander of the Army of Northern Virginia. No. You're subordinate under Robert E. Lee, and the whole situation has changed. We're not looking to fight a defensive battle. We've got the Federal Army on the run. We need to throw everything against them that we can and destroy them before they can bring their whole army up and outnumber us again. So Longstreet was supposed to go down and take these 2 hills at the end of the Cemetery Ridge at 8 o'clock in the morning. He didn't start his attack until 4 o'clock in the afternoon. And by that time, the Federals had reinforcements up on Little Round Top and their artillery up there. Now, Longstreet did drive out the Sickles, Daniel Sickles, and his 6th Corps, but they could not take the high ground there at Little Round Top, and part of his corps actually got up on Cemetery Ridge, and they could see all the wagon parks and the everything in the rear of the Federal Army, but they didn't have enough people there to hold it, and they were driven off. So now we move on to July the 3rd. Lee figures that if they're strong on their right flank and strong on their left flank, they must be weak in the center. So he decides they're going to hit the center of the Federal line after a long, tremendous artillery barrage and just wipe them out with artillery, then send the infantry in to clean up whatever's left. So, and the map that we're going to show you, if you can imagine a giant fish hook running north to south, that's the Federal lines. And we'll talk about that a little more in just a little bit.
And I'll have a question when we come back. Be right back, folks.
Are you ready to stand up for your community and support your local sheriff? Join the Constitutional Sheriffs and Peace Officers Association and become a vital member of the Sheriff's Citizens Posse. At CSPOA.org, we empower citizens like you through weekly webinars, arming you with the knowledge to back your constitutional county sheriff. Together, we can uphold our Constitution and ensure liberty and justice for all. Your community needs you now more than ever.
I'm Pastor Everett Ramsey, pastor of Faith Baptist Church, a congregation of God's covenant people. Informed Christians know that we are at the brink of a long-planned one-world government being executed that will not tolerate true Christian faith. There is a way to stop it. Our church has used God's spiritual weapons of warfare many times over the years, and in every case that was properly executed, the Church of Jesus Christ has been delivered. It is called the Court of Divine Justice. David used it many times. Read Psalm 37, Psalm 109. It includes truthful information, repentance, and imprecatory prayers. Blood River Radio is the only radio station I know that supports action based on truth about lies concerning the Confederacy, the Civil Rights Movement, the German people, the true Holocaust, and who the true covenant people of God are, and the sins and failures of the churches, if any of these. This means anything to you, and it should, then please say so with your money, as well as prayers. You may obtain information from us about the Courts of Divine Justice by sending your offering and request to Blood River Radio, and we take none of the money.
This is a battle between truth and deceit, a battle between forces that would enslave this country in darkness, and between a media that wants to present you with the truth.
We are being censored. America's news outlets no longer provide the truth. 90% of news outlets in the United States are controlled by 6 corporations. The mission of the Epoch Times is to chase the truth, to ground all statements in fact.
TheEpochTimes.com.
A Venus is a 44 Magnum, the most powerful handgun in the world, and would blow your head clean off. You've got to ask yourself one question. Do I feel lucky? Well, do you, Bunk?
Blood River Radio family. I just wish we had more time in this program. We talked about some really interesting things during the break, but I'm going to turn right back over to the bitter ender. I had asked if General Claiborne was ever involved in that battle of Gettysburg, but Gene told me that seldom ever, if ever at all, were any of the commanders in the Western Army, the Western theater, involved in the Eastern theater. But anyway, that's what we were talking about. So go back to you, bitter ender.
Okay. Now, one time that did happen, the Confederates finally figured out they had interior lines. It was easier to go from Richmond down through North Carolina across Georgia to Tennessee than it was for the Yankees to leave Virginia and go up through Pennsylvania, Ohio, all the way across Indiana and come down. So, but in Gettysburg, it was just the opposite. The Yankee Army had interior lines. If our listeners could imagine a giant fish hook, with the Yankee right at the point of the fish hook over on Culp's Hill, and then it curved around through Cemetery Hill. The shank ran down Cemetery Ridge, and then the eye in the fish hook was down at Little Round Top. So they could move reinforcements easily on interior lines. The Confederates had to go all the way around the outside of that to move troops from one position to another. So they decided to try to break the Union center on July the 3rd. There were three divisions that were going forward, one under George Pickett, Johnson Pettigrew, and Isaac Trimble, plus two more brigades from Anderson's division. And after an artillery bombardment, hopefully had softened up the Union lines, these Confederate attack, about 15,000 went forward. Small penetration, they did break through the Union lines, but reinforcements came in and drove them back. So the Confederates fell back to their position across the valley on Seminary Ridge and awaited a counterattack. They thought that the Federal Army was going to launch a counterattack since they'd been driven back. Didn't happen. Meade had had enough of being battered by Lee's army for 3 days. Now, oh, yeah, George Meade took over the command of the army while they were on the march. Hooker left Virginia, got, of course, up toward the Maryland state line, and then he was pulled out, and George Meade took over. So George Meade actually commanded the army during Gettysburg. And then on July 4th, the Confederate Army of Northern Virginia began their retreat back to Virginia. The other battle we're going to talk about occurred on June the 10th, 1864, at Bryce's Crossroads in northern Mississippi. This was one of the plans of the Federal Army. They sent out four separate armies during the spring and summer of 1864 for one purpose, to keep Confederate cavalry commander Nathan Bedford Forrest tied up in Mississippi and keep him away from the railroad lines that were supplying Sherman and his campaign to move out of Chattanooga, come down the Western Atlantic Railroad, and take Atlanta. Forrest defeated all four of them, or caused them to turn around and go back to Memphis, but the strategy worked. It kept Forrest stuck in Mississippi. He never got after the railroad lines until September, and by then it was too late. So one of the battles that he fought was at Bryce's Crossroads in June of 1864. A Federal Army under Samuel Sturgis, about 8,000 strong with 22 pieces of artillery and over 250 wagons, left out of Memphis, headed to northern Mississippi. Forrest had just a little over 3,000. And on that morning, he told one of his officers about 5 o'clock in the morning, they were riding up the Baldwin Road, heading toward the where they thought the Federal Army was going to be. And that, well, they knew they were going to be, because Forrest didn't leave anything to chance. They'd been scouting this army for 2 weeks. They knew exactly where they were and how they were doing this. He told one of his officers, they will send their cavalry out first. We will hit them in the woods around here, and the underbrush is so thick, they won't know how few of us there are. They will send back for the infantry. It's been hot. It's been raining. That road is narrow. It's muddy. It's going to be, and in Forrest's words, it's going to be hot as hell today. And by the time the infantry gets here, they'll be worn out, and we'll ride right over them. And that's exactly how they fought the battle.
Gee, the Yankee army probably couldn't. I bet the Yankee cavalry couldn't maneuver in that thick brush either.
Oh, no. And so Forrest kept spreading his men out in the woods and stretching the line out. And the Yankees, they thought they had them stopped. And then all of a sudden, there's firing over here on their left flank, and there's firing over here on the right flank. So they've got to pull people out of the line and move off to the north and south, to the left flank and right flank. They thought they were about to be overrun, and it was just Forrest's men making a lot of racket out in the woods, and they never knew how few of them they were because the underbrush was so thick. Bullets were flying at them, but they didn't know how many people were out there. So the Federal cavalry fell back, and by the time the infantry got to the Bryce house at the crossroads, the Federal cavalry was running through them in disorder and scattered their lines, and a lot of the infantry fell out from heat exhaustion, had heat stroke.
Well, I can identify with that.
Yeah. And Forrest routed them off the field that night and captured 20 of their 22 pieces of artillery, all 250 wagons. And General Sturgis had one of the best quotes of the war. They were heading back to Memphis as fast as they could go. And his officers were telling him, General, we need to make a stand. We need to make a stand. And Sturgis told him, oh, no, no. If Mr. Forrest, not General Forrest, Mr. Forrest, if Mr. Forrest will just leave me alone, I'll leave him alone. But Forrest wasn't about to leave him alone. No way. He stayed on him, for about 48 hours straight, and just picking up prisoners, broken down wagons, artillery, whatever they could grab that had just been left by the side of the road. This was called by military historians the perfect battle, because how could 3,000 people defeat 8,000? And it's the way forest strategy worked. And they've also said this was the first tank battle. And you're going, wait a minute, tanks didn't come along until World War I, 1914. But Forrest used his artillery to have these gunners pick up the trail of the cannon, push the wheels, and roll this artillery forward with his dismounted cavalry troopers and literally blast holes in the enemy lines. They were firing cannons from 50 and 100 yards away from the Federal lines. The artillery wasn't sitting back a mile away and lobbing shells. They double-loaded it with canister and turned these cannons into like giant shotguns and just blasted holes, which is basically what a tank does. It's an artillery piece mounted on tracks, and it clanks along and blows a hole in the enemy lines, and then the foot soldiers come in behind it. So that was John Morton and his artillery battery and Captain Rice. That's what they were doing. Those Confederate gunners picked those cannons up and pushed them by hand over 3 miles that day.
That takes energy.
Yeah, but 50 yards, 100 yards, 70 yards, whatever. But the total distance they rolled that gun, those guns were over 3 miles that day.
Mm-hmm.
So, and the difference was Forrest wasn't sitting back at headquarters and sending messengers out here, there, and everywhere. He was online with his troops, and he knew exactly where there was a weak point in the Confederate lines and the Federals were ready to counterattack. He could immediately send troops to plug that gap. Or he could see where the Federal lines were getting ready to break, and he would bring up his escort company or reserves, or he even told the horse holders, don't worry about holding the horses, tie the reins off to a tree and get in the line of battle. If we lose, you're not going to have to worry about the horses back there anyway.
Sure.
Get in the line of battle. And he could throw these extra troops in to weak points in the Federal lines. Unlike what happened, as we were talking about at Waterloo, where this huge portion of the French army was marching back and forth between the attack on Wellington, and then, no, they need them back over here, the attack on Blücher and the Prussians. No, they need them back over here to fight Wellington. Well, that 20,000 men never got in the battle all day long. So Forrest wasn't going to waste his men like that. He was right there and telling, you take your command, you go to this point in the Federal lines, and you unite with the other Confederates we have there and launch an attack right here. And when Forrest was right there looking at you and telling you, you didn't hesitate. He went wherever he told you to go.
And so, they knew, Gene, if they didn't do what he said, they're going to be hell to pay later, brother. I bet you.
Oh, my gosh, yes. Yeah. And he was out there with them. You know, he wasn't in the rear with the gear and sending messengers up and wanting to know what was going on. He was right on the lines and could tell you exactly what was happening. And it's like a football coach being down on the sideline with his team, because he can feel whether his team is confident or, you know, shaken or whatever, and try to build up their morale or threaten them or whatever you need to do to get the job done. And that's what Forrest was doing. He wasn't sitting up in the press box and sending orders down to somebody. He was out there on the field with them. So that was sort of the contrast between what happened at Waterloo and Gettysburg. If an officer wasn't carrying out the orders the way he wanted it done, he didn't have to wait until that night and find out, well, why didn't you do this? I didn't do this. This cost us the battle. He was right there on top of it. And if an officer wasn't getting the job done the way he wanted it, he was riding up behind them and chewing them out and cussing them and bringing up more troops to plug that gap or add more numbers to an attack and make it effective. So a little contrast there between two battles that we've all heard a lot about, Waterloo and Gettysburg, and then a battle that's not quite as famous, but just to show our listeners sort of the difference in what commanders do and how they handle situations like that. So I hope our listeners have learned something and gotten a little information on Waterloo, Gettysburg, and Bryce's Crossroads.
Well, I thought it was a unique program that you put on the night, Gene, because it's the first time we've ever told us about a foreign army, a French army. It's always been Confederate and Yankee. So you did an excellent job, and I thought that was extremely interesting, and I'd just like to chip in. We talked about during the break earlier, and the reason the whole damn world is up against French general. Because he kicked the bankers out of France. Napoleon. Yeah. The Jew bankers hated Napoleon. People, we've run out of time. Thank you so much for tuning in tonight. Thank you, Gene. Thank you, little Lizzie.